This is Alan Nell on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, etc. This is from the blog of my guest, setting aside for a moment the argument of whether dividing historic Palestine into two states was ever a good idea. Clearly, 40 years ago, it was a viable solution. Today, as liberal Zionist Jews and others call for this solution, it is a sad and pathetic sight. Zionism has created a state that wants nothing to do with peace or reconciliation. The problem is not Netanyahu. The problem is that the basic premise on which the Jewish state was founded is flawed. Well, this program prides itself on the robust discussion of these issues over the 20 years I've sat here, but I think tonight is going to be particularly provocative. But let me point out, as I did a little earlier, that my next guest's grandfather was a signatory to the Israeli Declaration of Independence. His dad was one of the architects of Israel's Six-Day War, so his Zionist roots are very deep. But Miko Pelad, his father and his grandfather, all ended up as peace activists in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Let's begin, if we may, by talking about your dad. I find it extraordinary that one of the top brass generals during the Six-Day War in 67 became one of the founders of the Israeli peace movement. Miko, how did that happen?
Well, you're right. It is extraordinary. But he was an extraordinary man. And as far as he saw it, there was really no contradiction. He believed that the most important thing was to maintain a Jewish democracy and to safeguard the Jewish state for which he fought, you know, during his entire military career. And he believed from a certain point in time, the right thing to do was to negotiate with the people with whom we share the land. In other words, the Palestinians, and that a Palestinian state in the West Bank and Gaza would safeguard the future of the Jewish state.
I've mentioned some of the men in your family. Let us now look briefly at your mother. Extraordinary story, because in 48 she refuses the offer of an Arab home in West Jerusalem when she learns that the family who lived there were being forced to live in a refugee camp.
True, yes. I remember her telling me this story as a young boy many, many times. She was born and raised in Jerusalem, many years before the State of Israel was established. And in West Jerusalem, there were several Palestinian neighborhoods. And she recalls walking through them on the weekend and seeing the families sitting in the front yard with a lemon tree and so forth. And in 1948, when these neighborhoods were evacuated, when the Israeli army forced the Palestinians to leave. As soon as they left, the army began bringing in Jewish families to take over these homes. And she lived, you know, she was a young mother with two children. Her husband, my father, was in the front line fighting. And she was offered this home. And what the way she described it, she said, "How could I possibly take a home of another mother? Can you imagine how much she must miss her home? And knowing that she lives in a refugee camp now, this is not something I can do."
Miko, you chose your parents well. I should point out that your family has been a victim of terrorism. You lost a 13-year-old niece to a Palestinian suicide bomber. Yet your father, a former military man, spoke with strained or curious objectivity about Palestinian terrorism. Tell us what he said.
Yes, he was asked about terrorism, and what he said was that terrorism is certainly a terrible thing, but the fact remains that when a smaller nation is ruled by a larger power, terrorism is the only means at their disposal. And as tragic as this may be, this is the reality. This is the way things are.
Why is the two-state solution looking so sick in your view? Why is it no longer the answer?
Well, over the decades since the 1967 war, consecutive Israeli governments, Israeli prime ministers have made it absolutely clear that the conquest of the West Bank is going, they're going to do everything they can to make the conquest of the West Bank irreversible. And the way they did this was by building massive Jewish settlements, Jewish towns in the West Bank. And this was no secret that this was their intention. And they succeeded. I mean, the West Bank today can no longer be delineated from the rest of the country. I think people have this impression that settlements are small little villages with, sparsely populated. But in fact, we're talking about major metropolitan areas.
We're talking about shopping malls, aren't we? We're talking about highways built on Palestinian land. Yeah.
And the problem is that all this investment was done excluding Palestinians. In other words, this is only for Israeli Jews.
Okay. How might a one-state solution look?
Well, we have two options. You know, one option is to leave things the way they are. Today, Israel and Palestine is one state. The entire population, whether they're Israeli or Palestinians, are governed, in fact, by the State of Israel. But the State of Israel does it in a way that it governs the different populations with different sets of laws. So you've got the Palestinians who live in the occupied territories in the West Bank and Gaza, who have absolutely no rights and no protection under the law and are governed by a brutal military regime. You've got the Palestinians who live within Israel and are third-class citizens, and there are over 20 laws in the books that discriminate against them. And then you've got the Jewish Israeli population who live under just a normal Western democracy. So it's already a one state. It's not like it's an option out of two. This is the reality. Israel governs the entire land, and Israel governs all 10 or 10 and a half million people who live there. The question now is this something that should continue, or should we strive to create a democracy where everybody enjoys equal rights and where the rule of law applies to everybody equally? And I think this is the better option of the two for many, many reasons. It's not only because it's just and it's the right thing to do, but it is going to save a lot of agony and bloodshed over the years.
You see the rise of fundamentalist religious officers in the IDF as the biggest threat to both Israelis and Palestinians. This might be a time to tell the listener about it, because this is not widely understood in Australia.
Well, the people always talk about religious fundamentalism in terms of the Arab world, in terms of the Islamic world, but there's a shift in Israeli society too. And there are a large number of and growing number of soldiers and officers in the Israeli Defense Forces who are religious fundamentalists, and this is, you know, the maintaining Israel's stronghold over the Palestinians and making sure that this is a zero sum game. In other words, that this is us or them, and it's going to be us at their expense. In other words, us, the Israelis, at the expense of the Palestinians, is going to be the reality. This is, as far as they're concerned, the most important objective. And this is very, very dangerous, because they are the military today.
I raise that because it's another problem in achieving the result that you, and I must admit I, would like to see. But it's not the only problem, is it? There's just so many of them. I would have thought that the demographic issue, where little by little the balance of population and therefore at least of potential power is changing between Jewish Israelis and Arab Israelis.
Yeah, I think this is a very racist point of view to assume that for some reason it's better for everybody if there are more Jews than there are Arabs. I don't think the Israelis have proven or shown that when they're in control, things are at all better. I think every single Israeli prime minister over the last 20 years has been accused of corruption, and there have been some very serious corruption charges. So I don't know that the Israelis have proven that when they're in control, things are better for everybody. And I think this whole demographic thing is a very racist thing. Whether there will be more Palestinians than there are Israelis eventually, that's the reality. Palestinians tend to have more children than Israelis do.
And also, is it not true that Orthodox Jews have more children than secular Jews?
Oh, yes, completely true. Yes, I mean they to have 8-10 children is not uncommon, but still they're a minority.
Yeah. Well, a very influential minority to such an extent that your family, who supported a secular Israel, must be quite concerned about.
Yes. Look, there are many reasons why this can't happen, and to achieve a real democracy. A secular democracy where equal rights reign is a complicated thing, but that's not to say that it can't happen. I think if somebody told us a year ago that Hosni Mubarak was going to fall as a result of a popular revolution, we would have been laughed out of the room.
Well, that raises, of course, the very important question of what the Arab Spring means for Israel and for the Palestinians.
I think the Palestinians actually began the Arab Spring. It's just that it's not commonly reported in the Western media so much. I mean, the Palestinians have had a popular uprising, albeit rather small, but very consistent and very persistent. Every single week on Friday and Saturday, there are nonviolent marches within the West Bank and in a variety of different places where Israelis and Palestinians march together against the occupation and are met with the brutal force of the Israeli army. So I think, in a way, they led the way, they led the path in this. I think this is a very good thing. I think the Egyptians have shown us that a popular revolution is possible, and that a military does not have to open fire on citizens. So,
Miko, how did the march? We talked about it before it happened, but we haven't reported on what happened. How did the march, the protest march, go in Israel a few weeks back?
The protest march.
Well, there was a large group of young Israelis who marched in protest pretty much against the tensions between the secular and the religious.
Well, Israel is also going through this its own kind of a spring protests, but it's a very internal thing. You know, people have been living in tents on the streets. It's called the tent revolution. As a result of growing, housing prices and so on and so forth, and so that's been going on for a couple of months now, actually. I think the problem again is that Israelis decided to divorce that issue from the larger issue of the Israel-Palestinian conflict, and when you do that, it's going to result in nothing.
Well, I did interview one of the organizers, and whenever I raised the Palestinian issue, she most emphatically changed the subject, but I just wanted to talk about it briefly with you. There's a video on the internet where you're talking about your upcoming book, The General's Son, and you talk very movingly about the 2007 Israeli attack on Gaza. Would you share your thoughts on that?
Yes, well, you know, on December the 27th, 2008, actually, Israel began a 21 massive brutal assault against the people of Gaza. On the very first day of the assault, Israel dropped 100 tons of bombs from the air on Gaza. And when you consider that a one-ton bomb will destroy a city block, and that Gaza has got one of the heaviest, is one of the most densely populated areas in the world, and that there are 800,000 children that live in Gaza, then you can imagine the devastation and the horror that took place there. And this was on the very first day of a 21-day attack. And I think that the timing of the attack, in other words, the attacks began at 11:25 in the morning, exactly the time when Palestinians took school children in Gaza are on the streets, because they've got two shifts of the school day, and this is exactly the time when the two shifts are on the streets changing. Is particularly telling, and for 21 days the people of Gaza suffered this brutal attack, and the world kept talking about, oh well, you know, they deserve it because there have been some Qassam rockets fired out of Gaza onto Israel. Whether they deserve it or not is, I think, a question of values. But the fact remains that at the end of 21 days, 1,400 people were killed. I think it's important for people to realize that Gaza has never had an army, never had a navy, never had a warplane, never had a warship. And we're talking about a massive army beating down a civilian population. And we're talking about the fact that 800,000 children were locked up in Gaza with no ability to escape, that there's no place for them to hide. as these attacks went on and on and on and on relentlessly for 21 days. I think this is going to be remembered as probably one of the darkest moments in the history of the Jewish people.
We've touched on your concern about the IDF, where over 30% of the officers are fundamentalists, and you talk of the danger of a Jewish version of the Taliban gaining momentum and gaining power. In the same breath, however, you talk about the illusion that a liberal, forward-thinking government can rise in Israel and then everything will be just as liberal Zionists wish it to be. This, in your view, is entirely pie in the sky.
Yes, it is. I think the problem is not only the religious fundamentalist. I mean, secular Israelis participate in this process of ethnic cleansing that's taking place against the Palestinians. So they're being educated. The education system, the secular education system in Israel, in terms of the issue of the Palestinians, is just as bad. In fact, there's a book that just came out analyzing how Palestinians are portrayed in the Israeli textbooks, and it's chilling. So the issue here is far larger than just the religious fundamentalists. It's also the regular secular. And the question always raised: how is it that the young men and women who are raised in a seemingly democratic society end up willingly enforcing this brutal occupation and acting in such horrific ways against a civilian population? And again, I have to emphasize this: the Palestinian population is a civilian population. Palestinians have never had any type of military force. And how is it that they can act so brutally against the civilian population? And this is a result of 12 years of Israeli education that prepares them for the day that they will be handed a gun and told to maintain this occupation.
Mika, you now live in San Diego in the U.S. Why did you leave Israel?
Well, I didn't leave Israel intentionally. I ended up in the United States, and then it was one of those, one thing led to another. You open a business, then you have children, and before you know it, 20 years go by. so it's not that I intentionally left. And I maintain very close ties, with my family. We visit, I take my family there every year. I visit there 2-3 times a year and maintain a very close contact. But I think having lived...
It's not a criticism. I was just curious about it.
No, I know. But I like to explain that because it sounds quite dramatic when you say, why did you leave?
Yeah.
The possibility of meeting Palestinians as equals, on as equal footing, in Israel does not exist. The only place where Israelis and Palestinians can meet as equals, where they're completely equal under the law, would be in a place, it would be like in America, as far as I'm concerned personally. And in fact, the first place that I did meet, and I talk about this in the book at great length, I grew up in Jerusalem, which is supposedly a mixed city, but it's also a very segregated city, excuse me. And the first time I actually met Palestinians in a setting where we were completely equal, where it was a social setting and it was relaxed, was in the United States, and I was almost 40 years old. And this allowed for a kind of dialogue that you can rarely find, if at all, between Israelis and Palestinians in Israel-Palestine. Mm. Because when you're on equal footing, the conversation is a completely different conversation than when you're not.
You're now living in a country where, of course, religious fundamentalism, Christian religious fundamentalism, is a major factor in the political relationships between the US and Israel. The other day, I was appalled to see that Glenn Beck, who has to be one of the nuttiest of the ultra-right wingers, was in fact given a great, almost a hero's welcome in Tel Aviv. This is not good, is it, the way this opportunistic relationship between two sorts of fundamentalisms?
No, I think both sides are using each other in a very cynical way. I don't think Glenn Beck cares one little bit about Jews or about Israel, and I don't think Israelis care about Glenn Beck. In fact, many Israelis have never heard of him.
But aren't they fortunate?
Yeah, but it suits both sides. I mean, I think people like Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and all those right wing fundamentalists in America, I don't think they believe anything they say. I think they know that it sells well, and it's a great way to make a lot of money on Fox, and that's why they do it. That's not to say their constituents don't believe them.
Okay, we've only got a few seconds left, but I'd like you to tell me briefly about the Elbena Pellid Foundation and why you started it.
Well, the Albana side, my friend and partner Nader Albana is a Palestinian from Nazareth who was forced into exile with, you know, many other families in 1948, and he was a child at the time. And he and I met through dialogue, excuse me, and at our first meeting he wasn't even willing to speak to me because I was an Israeli. And our relationship evolved over several years, and we found that when we work together, we can accomplish a great deal, and we decided that this would be a good model to show to people in America. And so we created the foundation. We've sent over 1,000 wheelchairs to Israeli and Palestinian children. We've sent medical equipment to Gaza and so forth. And it's the humanitarian work that I think is so important. That's that aspect of my activism.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Mieke, thanks for your time. Writer, you. Peace activist Mieke Pellett, who's in Australia on a public lecture tour. He's talking to me from Melbourne, I should have pointed that out. And we'll put details of dates on our website. His forthcoming book is called The General's Son and will be published later this year. And this is LNL on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, the World Wide Web and all that clever stuff. And I have to remind you that we'd like you to contact us and tell us what you think of stories. Many of you won't like that story, but don't hesitate to make that clear. And now, after a little bit of music, one of those quirky late night life stories, we take you to a tropical version of Amsterdam and tell you about a small minority group who've played a huge role in the modern history of Sri Lanka.